You're listening to the Story of Woman podcast with Lindsay Hansen Park.
About the third stop from where I boarded the bus, there were some white people got on and they took all the front seats.
To those waiting with bated breath for that favorite media catchphrase, the U-turn, I have only one thing to say. U-turn if you want to. The ladies, not a turn.
It is a violation of human rights when babies are denied food or drowned or suffocated or their spines broken simply because they are born girls.
I'm feeling honored that I'm being chosen to the Nobel Peace Prize.
If you are a black person and live in the black community and walk out on the street every day seeing white policemen surrounding you, and then you ask me whether I approve of violence, I mean, that just doesn't make any sense at all.
The Foreign Secretary about sexual violence and conflict, and Kashmir was not mentioned once. And this is a disgrace, and consider Kashmir was ignored.
She's gonna learn that this life will hit you hard in the face, wait for you to get back up just so it can kick you in the stomach. But getting the wind knocked out of you is the only way to remind your lungs how much they like the taste of air.
Eight thousand years ago, America looked like another world. Prairie grasses would have covered the land, and trees weren't very abundant. There wasn't a lot of forest, except for possibly in the extreme northeast. And the land itself was extremely dry. If it was frozen, it was a frozen desert, and when it was hot, it was a hot desert. The lakes were really reduced to water holes, and rivers were slowly withering into streams. But nature wasn't uninhabited. Aside from flora and fauna, there were small groups of native people who roamed through the wild hunting bison that were 50% larger than the bison that we know of today. They hunted what they called megafauna, animals, sort of like what we know now, like a deer, but a giant deer. They would have camped in river bottoms close to water so they could fish and hunt game. It's here that we meet a girl named Ayana. Now, this name is not her real name. It was actually coined by Professor Brian Sykes, author of The Seven Daughters of Eve, and he developed it for a particular Native American genetic line, reconstructed from the DNA of lines believed to have colonized America. And the name has become adopted mostly by English-speaking Americans, and it means ever-blooming. And I use this name because I'm a white American, and I don't want to appropriate a name, so I thought that this name would be fitting. And the reason why I'm naming this woman is I like to think of history and the stories of women, and in this series, we're going to be telling the histories of women. We're going to tell a lot of stories of women whose names we know. But the great majority of humanity and human beings, we don't know their names. And often, especially women of color, in our histories, are not named. We see them named as slave girl or Indian girl, or in the Western frontier histories that I read, Native American women were often named Sally. So whenever possible, I want to name people, I want to name these women. In our society, in much of human history, it's important to name things. And so I won't always get it right, but I want to give these women a name. So the story you're going to hear today is about Ayana. Now, like any human society, newcomers that come to a land, their spoken language included a name for their own group. And we don't know the name of that group either because it no longer exists. But archaeologists call Ayana's group Paleo-Indians. I imagine Ayana's scenario to go many, many different ways. I imagine her to be about 16 years old, strong, used to the wild, and used to the harsh conditions with her family. Perhaps she helped with her younger siblings, or perhaps she had lost all her family to famine or drought or hunger. But Ayana was strong enough that she was a hunter. She carried a dagger made from an elk's horn with her, and she had a pendant around her neck that she wore of a little snail shell. She must have been a good hunter to carry this dagger. And it was one day in the cold winter that she set off on a great lake near what is now present-day Minnesota. It was there she was probably trying to fish or hunt for her family. She would have been in a crude boat made out of animal skins or bark. Dugout canoes would have come much later, so the boats would have been very crude and not great for hunting. She was either in the boat or chipping through ice on the lake when she fell through into the water and she drowned. We know this because it was on June 16, 1931, that a highway department crew was working on the road when a grader blade suddenly bit into the soft earth. One of the crew members, Carl Steffen, who was following right behind the machine, said he saw something odd. So they went to look closer, and they were shocked to see an empty eye socket of a human skull peering up at them. Here's how Mr. Steffens told it. Quote, "We had this tough old guy who came over and said, 'This won't take long,' and jammed a shovel into the ground, but I warned him away from it. 'We'll make a man out of it,' he said." So Steffen and the crew tried to make a man out of these bones. They started to put these bones that they found together and build them together in anatomical order to make it into a man. What they didn't realize is they had discovered human remains that were far older than they ever could have imagined. They're the remains of Minnesota woman, who I have been calling Ayanna. Now, Ayanna is at least 8,000. There was an estimate of 8,000 to 20,000 years old, and she was found near Pelican Rapids, Minnesota, during this road construction in 1931. They believe she was about 16 years old when she died. She was not a mother. They could tell by her pelvis, but she did carry her dagger and her shell pendant, which could possibly have some religious symbols as a talisman to ward away evil, was later identified as fossils that only lived in Florida. So the pendant was important. It had traveled a long, long way. For Ayanna, she was not buried by her family or her tribe. She was buried in the soft earth with broken clam and mussel shells covering her body and this new highway that was about to cover her. The highway probably covered an extinct glacial lake. So because the shells were found on top of her, they realized that Ayanna most likely drowned. Her body was softly preserved under this layer of sediment for years and years and years. Her skeleton was mostly intact, and her ivory-colored bones showed every slight impression of blood vessel and brain matter. Minnesota woman, or Ayanna, was buried in South Dakota by the Sioux in 1999. Here's how the Minnesota newspaper describes it, quote, "There has been no water there for at least 10,000 years when Glacial Lake Pelican included all lakes in the Pelican River chain and covered considerable high ground as well, and the soil covering the body had been laid down centuries before that. In fact, the lake had been formed by melting of the great glaciers which covered most of our continent long ago. Prior to 1926, most scientists believe human beings' appearance in North America dated from about the last couple thousand years. The discovery of what was to be known as the original plaque labeled Minnesota Man, the name officially changed in 1976 to the Minnesota Woman, pushed the date even beyond that, back farther than anyone were willing to concede. Eventually, the evidence became irrefutable. Science now recognizes the Minnesota girl, who is sometimes referred to Lady of the Lake, as Proto-Indian, a member of a race who lived virtually in the shadow of glaciers at the end of the last ice age. Her forebears had come from East Central Asia, perhaps by walking across the Bering Strait on ice, perhaps on a land bridge exposed by lower sea levels. Retreating glaciers left a band of rich alluvial soil at their bases, upon which grew lush grasses to feed great herds of bison, elk, perhaps woolly mammoths as well. And wherever there was game, there were bands of prehistoric hunter-gatherers." If scientists are correct, the Pelican Rapids teenage girl dates back beyond the days of the pharaohs of Egypt and beyond the written history of humanity. That is the story of Ayanna. And unfortunately, her story is small. We only know a little bit about the story of her death. That is to say that she died, and she died in a tragic way. We hardly know much about her life, except for what we know about those who would have lived around her. And such is putting together the pieces of ancient history. We only have shadow details. We only have sketches. But their lives had just as much meaning and value. And in many, many ways, they are the early authors of human history. Even their very being is the author. It's the written language of the ancient past. Their bones, It's a language we still speak today. We leave behind us bones and artifacts, and so did our early ancestors. Now, generally the period between about 2 million years ago and about 3000 BC is called the Stone Age or the Paleolithic period. The word Paleolithic comes from the Greek word, which paleo means old and lithic means stone. Archaeologists divide the Paleolithic period into about three parts. The first part is in North America, and it had four developmental stages. There was Paleo-Indian, then the Archaic, then the Woodland and Mississippian. And we're going to talk about all of these coming up and find stories, because as we get into the future a little bit more, we start talking about civilizations that are incredible, that lived in the Americas thousands and thousands of years ago before any of us would even acknowledge their existence. Each of these four periods of prehistoric North America has its own cultural tradition. So Paleolithic period is one, the Paleo-Indian, the Archaic, the Woodland and Mississippian. Paleo-Indians were probably the first to use watercrafts on lakes in North America, just like Iana. Some of those lakes still exist today, like Lake Champlain, which borders New York, Vermont, and Canada, which was then part of the Champlain Sea. Paleo peoples would have made these rough boats while fishing and hunting along the lakeshore. And again, there's conflicting theories because there really isn't any evidence left over from these boats, because these boats would have decayed long ago. But we do know that they were fishing with boats. So we think that they built either skin crafts out of animal skins or small crafts from tree barks or hollowed out logs, except for the hollowed out boats come later to the Woodland period. We do know that Paleo Indians exploited large resource areas, including the uplands and the lowland regions of the land, and they likely followed seasonal migration routes of the tundra's herd animals. So a lot of their focus was focused on the hunting and the animals. The animals would have moved back and forth between upland and lowland regions along major water courses, and it seems that the early Paleo Indians would have done the same thing. Their campsites, however, are never found in the bottoms of river valleys, but really on the well-drained sand, including old marine beaches and deltas and outwashed terraces around valleys' margins. And it's important to note, as we're talking about excavating these old, old bones, these bones, especially in the early 20th century, were just thought to be, you know, more Native American graves. And because of how this history has happened, because these are direct ancestors to indigenous peoples of America, it's really important that ethical archaeology is involved. And until recently, archaeologists encountered very few obstacles when digging up and excavating the remains of the dead. And indigenous peoples, Native Americans, had little to no voice in planning or executing any of this research. Thanks to recent activism and lobbying by Native Americans, they had passed a passage in 1990 called the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. So the acronym is really long. It's NAGPRA, NAGPRA. It was enacted in 1990 to address complaints that archaeologists and museums had appropriated these human remains and sacred objects, and they were not rightfully theirs to control. So as the act is currently written, Native American tribes reclaim human remains and grave goods so they can establish a cultural affiliation, whether it's geographical, biological, archaeological, anthropological, or if they get historical data, oral history, or whatever on it. And in some cases, if the determination of affiliation is established, then they are allowed to have more say and more control. Although NAGPRA was created to relieve these tensions, to ensure equitable treatment of Native Americans, it has generated a fierce debate over who has legitimate claim to the use, ownership, and control of remains of indigenous people. It's a really complicated question. This is in part why the Sioux was able to bury the remains of Iana. Now, I'm a seventh generation American. I have family members who migrated here from European countries. I live mostly with other such white Americans who claim this land as their own. I live in a very conservative area where politically everybody considers themselves a patriot, which means they believe in God, guns, and country, and they really feel a sense of belonging as a patriot of America. But what's strange to think about is in our imperial sort of mindset around us, it's a colonized mindset. It's the idea that somehow this land is ours, that we have an right to it, that we earned it simply by being born here because of the work our ancestors done. But if that's the game we're going to play, then we have to realize how long this land, America, that I'm sitting in recording this from, has been inhabited by people, ancestors, that lived here long before my ancestors arrived. We are talking thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Thousands. Longer than the Bible's been around. Think about that. When we think of the colonial struggle, we like to think of the struggle between indigenous peoples from Western dime novels, right? Indians from picture books and movies. Or maybe pilgrims coming here with the first Indians and their loincloths and their feathers. But those Indians, while important, while their history is important, are just a dot in the overall picture of history. Their ancestors were here for millennia. And when the first humans came into these lands, they were evolved sapiens. We didn't have apes walking into the Americas. They were full sapiens who would have recognized if you were to transplant them into 2015 when I'm recording this, they would have been able to communicate with us and able to learn our language and understand, and us to them. Some of the earliest sites have been found in Alaska, followed by northern British Columbia, western Alberta, and the old Crow Flats in the region in Yukon. And archaeologists have found in these sites stone tools, weapons, pottery, and some dwellings. But how and when the Americas were populated remains really contentious. You see, even 50 years ago, there were thought to be possibly 5 different migrations. And it's been contentious ever since. I grew up with a Mormon background, and this debate is largely important to us as Mormons because we have scriptures called the Book of Mormon, which we believe was translated, that Joseph Smith, our founder, translated from ancient records to be a record of ancient peoples that inhabited North America. Now, of course, these ancient peoples are supposed to descend from Israelites coming across in boats. That's the story of the Book of Mormon. So we've long had a stake in trying to prove or disprove theories of migration because there's historical truth claims on the line when it comes to Mormonism's founding scriptures. So if you go to like BYU or get online, there are really heated debates on the migration issue. But there are also general theories, which is the Paleo-Indians, which span from about 15,000 BC to the end of the Pleistocene Ice Age, which was about 7,000 BC. And it's during this period that it would have been the first colonization of the New World by Homo sapiens. So from 15,000 BC to 7,000 BC. It's generally believed that early peoples came to the Americas from Asia, either by a land bridge, like I mentioned before, that formed across the Bering Strait. So they slowly hunted across the Bering Strait and came over here. Or there's the watercraft idea, which they could paddle from island to island. And we know that these inhabitants had to have migrated to the New World, because even after a century of intensive research, there have been no discovery made of early human ancestors that predate this period. This is why we talked about earlier, you know, all human beings coming out of Africa. Scientists believe that Paleo-Indians must have followed herds of animals such as mastodons, mammoths, camels, and bison as they cross this Bering land bridge from Siberia to Alaska. And the land bridge would have been made possible by the formation of huge glaciers and ice sheets, which caused water levels to drop more than 150 feet. As the water levels fell, the Aleutian Islands, which spread across the Bering Strait, would have been joined together, linking Asia to America. This is one of the theories. Now, I'm going to invite my anthropologist friend, Megan von Ackerman, to tell us a little bit more in layman's terms.
I'm Megan, and I'm an archaeology PhD student at the University of York, and I specialize in early medieval archaeology.
Okay, so tell us about the conflicts between wanting to pull a theory out of the data and what we can actually know from the data.
So archaeology gives us an enormous amount of information about the physical remains of our human predecessors. So we can tell a lot about who was there maybe and what they were doing, but we don't know a great deal about why they were doing it. And that's the problem, is that what we really want to know is the whys, the social questions about who they were and what they were thinking and what informed their behaviors. And those are the things that we actually have to infer from the physical remains that we get.
Okay, so how would that apply to the idea of how Paleo-Indians, the first colonization arrived in the Americas?
Well, that kind of information is particularly difficult. We're talking about the Mesolithic era. So we're talking about people that are working primarily in stone tools, but also in materials that don't actually show up a great deal in the archaeological record. So they're weaving things, they're making things out of wood, and those things decay and we can't actually see them. And so when we're doing archaeological digs, all that we're getting is the remains that we can actually see in the record, and they're often very, very difficult to detect. And the other problem is we don't often know where to dig. And so by the time we get there, we're looking for something that's really, really, really sort of ephemeral and difficult to see.
Okay, so, you know, we were talking in another place that there used to be these ideas of maybe five possible ways that people migrated out of Africa and eventually made it to Americas. And then there's this idea of one migration. And the most common theory is coming across, you know, from Siberia, the landmass from Siberia, from Asia into the Americas. But why is that controversial in the field? Why is that still even a source of debate?
So the migration from Siberia over into America is controversial because there is so little evidence. And so we're dealing with a lot of different fields that are pulling together different information. We've got linguistic evidence and we've got genetic evidence. And then we have the very, very ephemeral archaeological evidence. And the thing is that by the time we get enough archaeological evidence to say that a people have actually established themselves in the Americas, you're talking about a very significant number of people. When you think about that, that's because archaeological evidence depends on statistical biases.
In this whole episode, we're going to talk about how we interpret the data versus what is actually there. And so when you do your work, tell us about those conflicts. So if you were to tell our listeners going forward in this project, when they're listening to the data, how would you tell them to start thinking and looking at the way that we view this history?
So one of the problems is that there are only a certain number of activities that leave a tangible evidence in the archaeological record. Those have to be activities that affect materials that are going to last on and on. And those in the very, very early record tend to be lithic. They tend to be stone. Whereas the activities that are going to be related to fabrics or to wood and things like that are going to decay. And we really don't have the technology at the moment to trace those things. It's very, very difficult to follow them. So the problem is that we tend to concentrate on the activities that we can trace. We look at things like lithic points, spear points and arrow points, and we say, this is this particular culture. And what we're not seeing is maybe the weaving or the wattling or the building or the other things that have to do with wood or fabric or other things that also incorporated the culture, but don't leave their record in the fabric of the archaeological record. So we can't see them in soil. We can't see them when we actually excavate. And that's a problem that everybody's aware of, but it doesn't always get expressed to the general public. So when people are looking at the archaeological record and when they're looking at these sorts of reports, they need to think to themselves, not just, okay, who are these hunter-gatherers who are creating these lithic points, but what other activities were necessary in order to support or to coincide with the lithic activities? What were these peoples doing that related to these stone-based technologies?
So it's like someone looking at us hundreds of years from now and saying, you know, for several centuries, human beings ate forks, and they were the fork people because they could find evidence of forks. It's like taking one part of our life and, you know, extrapolating a whole culture from a very small part of their life.
Absolutely. And it's really frustrating because we have so little understanding of what other technologies might have been going on and how important they were to these peoples. And for a very long time, the lithic points and these stone things were the focus of all of our concentration. And we didn't think about the other things that were going on around them.
Now, when we're talking about this land migration of how, you know, sapiens made it into the Americas, it's really controversial. And some people think there was a single migration and some people think there are multiple migration. And there are geneticists that come in and linguists that come in and biologists that come in. Can you talk about how they're in archaeology alone? You sort of mentioned this, but there are all these different fields of studies that have to come in. Like you said, like what's in the soil? Will you explain to us why something like a soil would be important to understanding the archaeological record?
Absolutely. I think it's really fascinating because you've got these fascinating different disciplines that are coming together to give you all this information. But when it comes to archaeology, we're really, really limited what we find in the earth, whatever we can dig up. And the problem with archaeology is that you can only find what's there, and you can only find what's there where you're looking. And when you consider the vast amount of territory that's involved in the area around the Beringia point, the point where all of these invasions were assumed to have happened, that's a huge amount of land. And we're talking about people who were leaving really, really, really little evidence in their wake. Very, very few stone points, and all of their other technologies were probably going to disappear into the archaeological evidence. We're not going to be able to find traces of them. So it's extraordinarily difficult to find them. So when we talk about something like, oh, we think these peoples probably arrived around, say, 15,000 years ago, that simply means that we have evidence 15,000 years ago of people who came in enough numbers who were leaving enough evidence that we find that. But when you think about it, that means that they were probably here for enormous amounts of time before that, because it took that much time for them to build up those numbers and build up that technology for us to recognize them in the evidence.
So this idea, this controversy of who came here first, and how they came here is really spotty, even though we have geneticists that are starting to track DNA and, you know, track the ancestry of indigenous peoples here, or archaeologists that find stone tools, say, in like Northern America and can date it. What you're saying is these are all just small, small parts, sentences in the whole story of the migration.
Absolutely. And they're important points, and they're not points that we need to ignore or put aside. I think that we tend to think far too conservatively about the abilities of our forebears. I think they were far more capable than we think they were, and I think that they were far more able to move than we think they were. And so when we look at these dates and things, we need to see them as the least possible date. And probably people were moving earlier than that.
Well, thanks so much, Megan, for taking the time to talk to us a little bit about your field of study.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Several thousand years after these first migrations, the first complex civilizations arose and settled into communities. So we have what we're going to call hunter-gatherers, and we're going to unpack that term in just a minute. And hunter-gatherers sort of evolve into these semi-agricultural communities as we learn to domesticate agriculture. So that becomes important too. These early civilizations are fascinating, and that's what we're going to focus the next few episodes on. Complex civilizations like the Norte Chico civilization, also known as the Caral Supe. It's one of the oldest civilizations known in the Americas, and one of the six sites where civilization originated independently and indigenously in the ancient world. It was contemporaneous with Egypt and things like that, so we'll talk about that coming up. But I want to talk about the first women in the Americas. Now, this is an interesting topic. The title of this episode is Make a Man Out of It. We know that it is hard to date the biological sex of bones, as we pointed out in the Red Woman episode. New and gendered interpretations of archaeology has allowed anthropologists and archaeologists not just to look at Paleo-Indians through the lens of men anymore, especially the lens of a male hunter, but better explore the role that women had in building their world and society. This idea as men and women as hunter-gatherer, this was seen as a very gendered sort of cooperation between the sexes. Women would stay home and take care of the children, and men would go out and hunt. And we sort of take our own Western sort of American ideals and put them on these ancient peoples. And thus we get the hunter-gatherer society. But here's the thing. This is the thing that we need to know, especially me growing up in a very conservative religion where we have very distinct gender division, where the husbands go out and work and bring in the food and the money, and the women stay back and take care of the young and cook. That's very much like a Mormon ideal. It's very much a 1950s American ideal. And it's very much this hunter-gatherer ideal. And if you were to step outside that paradigm, it's really controversial. And I even remember growing up looking down at women that worked outside the home, working mothers. Because we grew up thinking that this is the traditional family, meaning this is what society was meant to do, it's what it's always done, and the best mothers are the ones that stay home and take care of their children. But that's a really, really very, very small view of human history. In fact, the working mother is nothing new. If anything, it is the tradition. In Woman the Gatherer, Adrienne Zillman, Frances Dahlberg, and others fill in a lot of gaps in our model of human evolution by emphasizing facts about women and how their ancestors might have been missed by male anthropologists. And I'll link to it, because the first book that comes out is Man the Hunter, and the follow-up book is Woman the Gatherer, where they break down some of these paradigms. So when scientists start finding these bones, they start interpreting it in a way that really plays into this Western idea of gender division. This idea that women would gather the food while the men went out and hunted big game is very similar to my upbringing as a Mormon girl in Utah. But male anthropologists and female anthropologists were looking at their research through a very contemporary worldview, one that was shaped possibly by their own understanding of gender roles. There's another great book that talks about this and talks about the way that science is changing. It's called Women in Americas by Kevin Olson Bruins, and I'll link to that as well. Archaeologists are now starting to deconstruct gender roles. Originally attributed to these hunter-gatherer societies. Now notice when I say unpack this word that we say hunter-gatherers, which puts the male role responsibility first. Man the hunter. This is the important idea, and gatherers follows it. It puts women nicely at the side as the helpmeet to the man. Before radiocarbon dating was available, scientists had to focus on man the hunter because the majority of their sites were kill sites that they found. And at these kill sites, which were easy to dig up because they were large and they were more common, they were able to find bone tools and weapons. Now, how these early paleo Indians would have lived, they would have had campsites and kill sites. The campsites would have easily been covered up or diminished or decayed over time. But kill sites, because they left bones, were a little bit less hard to disappear. And thus we had the evidence of that, which gave us evidence of man's importance, because for some reason, their written history was a lot louder than the history of a lot of paleo Indian women. Because we had so many kill sites to focus on, this developed the idea that paleo Indians were all most likely all hunters. But this is the old model, one with a kill site focus that made scientists and the world believe that early American peoples were all big game hunters, killing mammoths, giant bison, and similar large species. We developed a view that each band would hunt big game to herd extinction, maybe chase them off a cliff to a slaughter site, and then, you know, slaughter them at the kill site and move on to other herds. This left out the fact that the majority of these kill sites were found in Northern American grasslands, so this is only a small part of how these people lived. And it also sidelined tools found at the sites, those of flake tools that were used for smaller, less aggressive tasks. Flake tools became overshadowed by these aggressive slaughter sites and the weapons found there. Man the Hunter dominated scholarly thinking for a long time. The Man the Hunter myth held that all human progress was owed to the aggressive male hunters developing stone tools and driving culture and the human race forward. Hunting tools were seen as the cause and evidence of human progress. And the majority of scholarly research held on to these studies that the Inuit and Eskimo and early Cree people were examples of this and considered them sort of a living history, a living fossil, and conflated their behavior with all of paleo Indians spread throughout the Americas in a vast array of different climates and cultures. If you're to take other living fossils, though, if you look at the Philippines population, women are involved in hunting and honey collecting, and while there is still a division of labor, overall men and women contribute a similar number of calories to the camp. In both groups, monogamy is the norm and men are active in childcare. Andrew Migliano, who we talked about in our last episode at the University College of London, said, "Sex equality suggests a scenario where unique human traits such as cooperation with unrelated individuals could have emerged in our evolutionary past." Many scholars are now stressing an interdependence between the gatherers and the hunters. Because kill sites and big weapons interested scholars, the focus was mostly on their use. Joan Garrow is a feminist anthropologist who has long been challenging these androcentric ideas of the hunter-gatherer, and she does this by challenging the idea of tool-making. First, there is a huge common assumption that tool-making is associated with men. Men were the stone tool-makers. The predominant idea is that these stone tools are made by men. They're weapons, they're part of the male process of hunting, and they're made by men. Well, Joan Garrow has really worked hard to push back on this idea. The argument behind the assumption is that men possess a greater upper body strength, and thus they are able to do more hunting and more tool making. And Garrow dismisses this. She points out that physical strength is not the key quality in being skilled at making stone tools. And in fact, she points out the great emphasis in research time and money towards studies concerned with these most masculine of stone tools, such as projectile points. While stone tools likely made and used by women, for example, with the flake tools, had in the past been relatively ignored. Here's what Garrow says in her book Gender Lithics. Quote, "What is a stone tool? Where did the definition come from? The study of stone tool, the material remains most closely associated with evolving hominids, speaks directly to the validation of being human. It is not coincidental that the early studies of stone tools and tool makers occurred in the heady flush of newly accepted evolutionary theory. While ethnologists analyze contemporary savages and barbarians for evidence of the successive ages and stages through which humanity had evolved and progressed, archaeologists unearthed direct evidence of brutish early man from the material record. Spearheads and axes, weapons and implements fashioned out of stone were identified as the essence of man's rude beginnings, savage indeed, as beginnings must be, but also full of the clever promise that makes them appropriate hallmarks of human ability. Accompanying with this early attention to the forms of stone tools were the related attempts to understand their technology of manufacture, and different tool forms were frequently replicated in experimental undertakings during the late 19th century and early 20th century to identify the nature and capacity of early man. And note, please, man is not a semantic generalization. Such tools were seen, without doubt, as a product of male labor. The definition of what constitutes a tool, then, is ultimately wrapped up in how man the toolmaker demonstrates his humanness. Tools provide a thermometer for measuring intellectual heat. As though making tools is what man does, and once made, these tools have completed their function. To bear testimony to man's abilities. Today's lithic analysis has not completely outgrown these beginnings, but still focuses on the production and final forms of elaborately finished tools, with only secondary regard to the range of economic and cultural goals accomplished by these tools. The first primary distinctions in lithic analysis are still made between the end products of the manufacturing sequence, tools, and the byproduct of manufacture, cores, and debitage, so that the production sequence, rather than use application still predomination, is tool analysis. These distinctions were underscored by further cladisfactory groupings. Artifacts were obviously used, but had not been subjected to the productive stages to being made into a standardized shape, as referred to not as tools, but as utilized flakes, or even more emphatically as unretouched flakes, with emphasis retained on the amount of production or lack of it. Tools, it is clear, is a term remained for categories of elaborate retouched artifacts with formal structure, although the question is clearly begged. When does one use a tool, and when does one utilize a flake? In fact, of course, utilized flakes are tools, Although in the literature, tools are still frequently comprised of only standardized, classifiable, reproduced forms of worked stone. Thus, Hayden writes that among the Australian Aborigines, he was surprised to confront, quote, the unbelievable lack or rarity of what the archaeologists call tools. At first, I saw Aborigines using only unretouched primary flakes for shaving and scraping wood, and unmodified blocks of stone for chopping wood. None of these would have been recognized archaeologically as tools. As Hayden suggests, part of the conventional loading of the term tools towards elaborated and retouched forms derives from the real difficulty the archaeologists have had in recognizing unretouched flakes that may have been used as tools. In lithic studies expressly designed to detect artifact use, the term tool or tool edge is applied much more generally to any stone that exhibits evidence of having been used, and a much broader, more inclusive range of artifact forms is covered by the tool term. In functional analysis, and especially in use-wear studies, where microscopic analysis of an artifact's edge may reveal evidence of how it was used, the identifying criteria are turned around and use defines toolness, clarifying the distinction between unused flakes and tools. Garrow goes on to talk about how the way that we even look at and define our terms in archaeology have had a bias towards the male lens. Flake tools have recently become more and more interesting to scholars and show that the process of hunting wasn't just about the big, strong tribesmen going to kill the big game with big tools. There were other tasks involved in the process, and the way that we have previously talked about and recorded hunting have erased the responsibilities of women, males of other ages, and children. Flake tools teach us a lot about human history. They can do analysis to learn what was processed by the flake tools. They can do this really cool thing called refitting, where they take the process of putting rock shards back together in the original order to sort of get an idea of how the tool was created. So they build the tool backwards. They rebuild it into a rock. They're realizing flake tools were of huge importance, and that they were focusing so much on a man holding a spear chasing a bison, whereas that wasn't really the story. That was only a speck of the story. The past was broader than anyone could have believed, and it contained more actors and more parts. And this gender-based script of man the hunter and woman the gatherer taking care of children and perhaps picking berries was very possibly set up by early Americans. It is how we look at the division of labor that becomes problematic. While division of labor might have existed, it becomes problematic in the way we interpret it. For example, let's look at material culture. Material culture, that of finding clothing, garments, blankets, flake tools, pottery, if they were indeed crafted by women, they are in a very real sense the written histories of women, since women in ancient days were largely restricted from education or learning. For a long time, written histories in Egypt, let's say, were only given to wealthy scribes that were male, born into the right families. Writing and history was very limited to women. So women told their stories in other ways. They told it through material culture, through their weaving, through their clothing, through their garments, through their pottery. And of course, these are no simple things. Garment production, for example, is highly specialized labor. It doesn't take a lesser intelligence. To make clothing out of animal skin in the Paleolithic period would have been a highly difficult process that would have taken training, ritual, and skill. Women would have benefited from men hunting and bringing home the skins, where they were skinned, tanned, stitched, and adorned into clothing. And this would have been a task that incorporated both genders, would have taken training and passing this down and down and down. Transforming hides into shelter would have taken men and women to integrate this division of labor into a cooperative status. Another example of how women's history is erased is that of art. There was a study published in 2013 that suggests that women are some of the earliest artists that we know of. Does this mean that women were just somehow relegated to these roles, that they were inherently used to creating art, that their maybe fine motor skills made them more inept to do art? That they were somehow biologically ingrained to do art? Of course not. But this is how we analyze the data with the hunter-gatherers. We say, well, because we have this evidence, this must mean that men were like this and women are like this. Archaeologist Dean Snow of Pennsylvania State University analyzed the hand stencils found in 8 cave sites in France and Spain, And by comparing the relative lengths of certain fingers, Snow determined that 3/4 of the handprints were females. There has long been a male bias in the literature for a long time, said Snow, whose research was supported by the National Geographic Society Committee for Research and Exploration. People have made a lot of unwarranted assumptions about who made these things and why. If we take the data of the cave drawings and say women are inherently artists and men are inherently hunters, that gives us a really flawed concept of who human beings are. There's another great book called Distorting the Past by Linda Owen and is largely centered on studying the activities that were often associated with women, like gathering, hunting small game, fishing, etc. And she gives us extremely detailed analysis of these tasks. And the book stresses those tasks and their importance, not only in terms of dietary factors, but also notes that those activities supply these groups with materials that were used to make clothing, containers, tools, etc. And the analysis of these activities are very important because they use a vast array of informational sources. And they clearly show that the traditional feminine activities had much more importance in terms of subsistence than we generally thought. It also makes clear that the assumptions about female biology and typical factors that are usually put forward to attribute them to, you know, role of gatherers or childbearers, disassociate them from any prominent roles in the subsistence strategies from their group, and are more the excuses that support biased accounts and studies than solid data from ethnographic and archaeological investigations. We're looking at the data wrong. In many cases, these claims are supported by little or no evidence at all, and in most of them, they are gross generalizations, which are clearly false, as these factors and their effects vary greatly in the way that they affect women's lives. There is such a struggle in our modern age to prove that men behaved one way and women behaved another, as if we are biologically locked into our ancient primate ancestors' roles. Of course it's true that primates are more aggressive as male and female, and their roles are delegated. So because of this, we say this is how human beings are programmed to act, and we have to go with it. A lot of talk about what is natural is dangerous. It's dangerous. We see it now. We see it now used to support different political agendas, and it's dangerous in our overall generalizations. It's natural, so it must be. Because as Harari says in his book Sapiens, if it's natural, it's possible. So that means we could argue that anything that is possible is natural. And if we say that it's natural and it must be done, then that's a problem. Is it possible that our primate ancestors were sexist macho apes who dominated over harems of women? Of course. But their children found a better way. And that better way led them to thrive and survive. And that is our task. Thanks for listening to another episode of Story of Woman Podcast. The Story of Woman Podcast is brought to you by Bluehost. Consider telling your own story and sign up with Bluehost. If you go onto thestoryofwoman.org and look on the right-hand side, there's a Bluehost button right there for you. Click on it and set up your own site to tell your story. Special thanks to Lady Murasaki, who provides us amazing music. Check them out at ladymurasaki.bandcamp.com. If you like what you hear today, consider supporting the podcast at storyofwoman.org. We take donations that support the telling of women's stories. Consider a donation at storyofwoman.org.